You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the impact of a Wisconsin law known as the Unborn Child Protection Act, intended to prevent drug use during pregnancy. It can give authorities the power to detain people without their consent. Now, finally, we're going to get some answers to questions that we know may or may not have been on anyone's minds recently about the humble house sparrow. The song of the sparrow there. Why? Well, a couple months back, I talked to the author of a book who said we should pay more attention to the birds around us, even, you know, the boring ones, the ones you don't go out and try to find. I tried. The birds I see the most lately are these house sparrows, in some ways arguably the boringest of birds. Nicholas Anich is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm being a little unfair to the house sparrow here. They're actually, I think, kind of interesting when you start to look at them. But first, for non-bird watchers like me, can you give us a basic description of those house sparrows?
Yeah, so they are a little bit on the boring side. They are kind of a brown and gray bird, what people typically think of when they think of a sparrow.
Yeah, and when I looked up descriptions, they used words like, you know, dingy and dull in describing the colors. These are official descriptions. These don't really pop out at you, do they?
No, and in some way they have kind of earned their bad reputation, as they are a non-native species to this continent.
Yeah, and I was reading up on this. I remember hearing a story of a guy in the 19th century who introduced birds that he'd read about in Shakespeare and introduced them to the U.S. These were at least initially deliberately introduced in the U.S. and took off and spread all over?
Yeah, during the 1800s, it was a big thing. There were these acclimatization societies where European immigrants wanted their familiar plants and animals around them. And so, for better or worse, they introduced, you know, dozens of species to other places.
In the winter, it seems like house sparrows, if you want to look up and see a bird, they're the most likely one you're going to find. Why have they so successfully adapted in Wisconsin and a lot of the rest of the country?
Well, they've basically adapted to be around humans. So whenever they were introduced to areas where people occupied, they like feeding on, you know, seeds and spilled grains and other things like that. So they're you're not going to find them in the deep woods, but if you are in a sizable city or a farm area, they are very common there.
Now, when I look up house sparrows online, it seems like a lot of the common questions are negative. How do I get rid of house sparrows? Or are house sparrows crowding out native species in Wisconsin? Are they a problem for local native species?
Well, they can be a problem, and the real bad thing about them is that they're a cavity nester, and so they are going to be using birdhouses that other native species like eastern bluebird or purple martin might be using. So that's kind of the worst part about them, and they are kind of aggressive. So if you're trying to get bluebirds to nest in your box and you have house sparrows around, they might kick out the bluebirds and take the box.
Now, I've described them as boring. I hope they're not listening so they don't attack me at the bus stop tomorrow. But are there things you find interesting, maybe fascinating, about house sparrows and their behavior?
Well, I mean, they have successfully colonized basically the whole world except for Antarctica. They are very comfortable around humans. They're very persistent. I mean, they love nesting in little cracks in the wall and very hardy. So, I mean, they are, you know, kind of victorious as far as colonizing the world.
Do we have any sense? I don't know if we have numbers or if we can even keep track of numbers. Do we have a sense of their prevalence, how many of them are in the state?
Yeah, they are among the top 10 most common species, along with European starling, which is another exotic species. So they have kind of quickly jumped up the list to be quite common.
Talking to Nicholas Anich, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, looking at the house sparrows, a common bird you could see in the winter here in Wisconsin, especially in towns and cities. I also wanted to ask you, though, Nicholas, you are working on a new edition, second edition of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, that's right. It's a statewide citizen science project. And so the first bird atlas occurred from 1995 to 2000. And we just finished the field work for this one from 2015 to 2019. We had over 3,500 surveyors, and we gridded up the whole state into blocks that are about 3 miles by 3 miles. And we went into 1,200 of those blocks to collect data on all of the birds that were nesting there. And so with the most recent atlas, we've accrued 2.8 million observations. And we were collecting data in eBird, which is the popular online app for reporting your bird sightings. During that window, there were 8 million bird observations reported to eBird for Wisconsin. And so we have spent the last couple of years combing through all the atlas data and all the regular eBird data to try to make sure that everything lines up, looking at the time of year, the location, trying to vet that data before we move on to the more exciting steps of analyzing it to see how all of our bird species have changed in the last 20 years.
I know you're still vetting the data, and I don't know, maybe you don't want to spoil things or anything, but has anything stood out to you or surprised you so far as you're digging deep into this data?
Well, like any scientist, I'll put the asterisk that this is all preliminary, but initial analyses have kind of revealed some general trends, winners and losers, if you will, species whose range has grown or shrunk in the last 20 years. Some of the big losers are birds that are, we are at the southern edge of their range. So most of their range is in like the Canadian boreal forest. So these are birds like Canada jay or boreal chickadee or blackback woodpecker or Connecticut warbler. Those are some of the species that we are seeing reduced range, and they are retracting and leaving the state. Another big category of birds that aren't doing that great is grassland birds. Birds like northern bobwhite, upland sandpiper, western meadowlark. Those are birds that, perhaps more intensive agricultural practices are harming. On the flip side, we do have some big gainers. Like the birds who we're at the southern end of their range, they are gradually shifting north. The birds where most of their range is to the south of us, we are getting more of them. So some of those species would be Carolina wren, tufted titmouse, and orchard oriole. Those are some of the big gainers. Another theme for gainers is raptors. You probably know that since banning DDT, raptor populations have been doing a lot better. So birds like peregrine falcon, bald eagle, and merlin were doing quite a bit better. And then amongst our biggest gainer is trumpeter swan.
Interesting. We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Nicholas Anich, conservation biologist with the state DNR. He joins us to talk about house sparrows and preview the DNR's Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2. Now it's Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a comeback story about a special band of horses.
Thousands of Ojibwe horses once roamed in the northern United States and Canada in the early 20th century, but the rare breed almost disappeared by the late 1970s. Then recently, a descendant of the White Earth Nation rescued six Ojibwe horses and gave them a home in northwestern Wisconsin. WPR's Danielle Kading brings us this story about Emily Lorzel and the Humble Horse Organization, which aims to keep the rare breed alive.
I know, Mama. White Earth Indigenous cause. Mityu or Ojibwe Anishinaabe Kwe Mityu. So that's a traditional Ojibwe protocol greeting. My name is Emily Lorzel. I founded this, and my husband and I, we both live on site, so we attend to all of the daily needs of the herd, including things like fundraising and outreach and stuff like that. But it's a volunteer-ran organization, so we don't get paid for anything that we do. All the donations go straight back for the horses. A part of our mission here at the Humble Horse is to preserve the breed and to hopefully one day repatriate them back to Anishinaabe communities.
Itchy. In Anishinaabe culture, if you don't have a name, your ancestors can't find you. So we gave everybody Anishinaabe names. That's Nojimo, or we call her Jimmy. And that's Dimi, but we call her Mama. And then there's Baswewe, which is Echo. And then this is Nimki, who I guarantee you, once you start giving him pets, he will stalk you to the end of days, because he is like, hi, Mama. Just the friendliest. I have an
Auntie Siobhan Marks and Uncle Mark Denning. Uncle Mark actually grew up with these horses, or he grew up with ponies, these small little ponies in the forest, right? I learned about these horses from him, and he would always tell me that his dream was to see these horses back in Wisconsin, because as he was growing up with them, they eventually kind of disappeared. What we do know is there were only about four left in 1976. The last stallion was shot by a non-Indigenous researcher who thought he was a moose in the 1960s. So with only four mares left in 1976, and the Canadian government saying, these guys are a public nuisance, we're going to destroy them, four members from Fort Boys and Lac La Croix Nations got together in the middle of the night, loaded these four mares up onto a horse trailer, actually border hopped over the ice. It's called Heist Across the Ice. And they found sanctuary in a farm in Minnesota. They were able to repopulate, and they were crossbred with a Spanish Mustang that was kind of the most phenotypically similar to the breed. So all of the horses today are related to those four mares. I didn't know we had horses until I was in my early 20s. And why is it that I didn't know about these horses until I was that age? These horses were so vital to our survival. What's cool about it is it was a consensual relationship. We didn't have to keep them penned up. They would come back every year around the winter to help us check trap lines, haul logs. There's even stories of them pawing through ice to help with ice fishing. So because they helped Anishinaabe people survive and we consider them a relative, I guess my question would be, wouldn't you help your relative survive?
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on Ojibwe horses. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Wisconsin has one of the strictest fetal protection laws in the nation. An investigative reporter tells us what it means. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Wisconsin passed a fetal protection law back in 1997 that's seen as one of the strictest in the nation. Wisconsin is one of just five states where pregnant people can be imprisoned on suspicion of drug use. About 400 pregnant people each year are investigated under the law. The law, known as Act 292, in effect grants many legal protections to zygotes. Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch. I talked to her earlier today. Can you give us the basics of what this Act 292 actually does?
Yeah, so this aims to protect gestating fetuses from potential harm from drugs or alcohol. But in doing so, it deprives pregnant people of civil liberties and is considered by some the most extreme law in the country of this kind, because it allows anyone to file a complaint with the local child protective services saying that a pregnant person is using drugs or alcohol. And then that kicks off a process where ultimately the state can force a pregnant woman into treatment or civilly detain her against her will for the entire duration of her pregnancy. And if she refuses treatment, she can even end up in jail.
Talk just a bit about the origins. This is something comparable laws, though not as maybe severe, were happening in other states in the 90s. Give us a little bit of the background that led to states passing these kind of laws.
Yeah, so this really came about amid the war on drugs and this crack baby hysteria, when people thought that children born to mothers who use crack cocaine were doomed to lives of suffering, which has now been debunked. And there also was a very racist, overtly racist element to this, where we in the national media were focused on Black and brown mothers specifically, even though at the time, white folks were using crack cocaine actually more. So this law put unborn children under the auspices of the Department of Children and Families. It was a really small change with super big consequences. We're the only state to have a law like this that explicitly defines unborn children as human zygotes, embryos, and fetuses, basically from the moment of conception.
And you follow the story of a woman who's been at the center of this, including court cases, Tamara Lacher. Can you tell us a bit about her story?
Yeah, so when this all started in 2014 for her, she was 29 years old. She was a single woman. And her case really shows the extreme lengths or situations this law can put people in and the harm that it can cause. Because today she has a healthy 7 or 8 year old son who she loves, but she's still very traumatized by what happened to her. So back in 2014, she thought she might be pregnant. She went to the hospital for treatment for severe hypothyroidism and depression. One of the doctors said that it was amazing her fetus had even survived past the first trimester because she was so sick. Test results show that she was pregnant and had unconfirmed positives for some drugs. And so the hospital told the county, and they didn't let her leave the hospital. They had a court hearing while she was in the hospital where they said, you need to go to inpatient residential treatment. She was very clear that she didn't have a drug dependency. She was self-medicating for her hypothyroidism and depression, but she was here at the hospital supposed to be getting help. And she went back and forth, ended up having several court hearings, and was told throughout this that she was going to lose her child if she didn't cooperate. So she checked herself into jail instead of going through with treatment because she wanted to fight for her child. And with some lawyers, she was able to get a federal judge to say that this law was unconstitutionally vague and was voided. But that was later overturned on a technicality. And she really blames herself for that today.
Yeah, and that's an important point. It looked like this law was going to go away, ruled, as you said, unconstitutional. A very minor technicality of involving her leaving the state for a while means, if I have this right, this law, this Act 292, still in place here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's still in place today. And the interesting thing about it is that that legal justification that this is unconstitutionally vague still stands. Nothing, as far as I can tell, has been changed in the law to make it less vague. And so the one of the ways to change this potentially is another brave woman like Tammy coming forward who's experiencing this and challenging it again, because that justification kind of still stands. So it could be very persuasive to a judge in the future.
Talking to Phoebe Petrovic with Wisconsin Watch, looking at her reporting on Wisconsin's fetal protection law and the impact it can have. Phoebe, one side effect of this, and you write about this, is a concern that if a woman hears about this law and is worried that, you know, that she's had past drug use, it might deter people from going and seeking prenatal medical care.
Right. That's a huge concern for many providers of mental health care, of substance use, and of obstetrics and gynecology. And I think one really good example of this is a woman named Alicia Beltran, who tried to challenge the law prior to Tammy Leitcher. She had a Percocet dependency. She weaned herself off of it successfully using Suboxone by herself because she couldn't afford medical treatment. And when the doctor found out and found that she had tested positive for Suboxone, they wanted her to go back on it. And she ended up being detained. And so when she had a second pregnancy, her provider told me, her OBGYN told me that she totally avoided getting prenatal care for that pregnancy because she had been so traumatized by being jailed after doing the right thing and recovering.
Now, we've had Roe v. Wade overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, bringing back Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban. Is there a concern that this is going to make this fetal protection law more active, more used in the state?
Yeah, so Tammy Leitcher's attorney, Freya Bowen, was really worried about that because, you know, it sort of depends on if someone at the hospital decides to contact social services. But theoretically, anyone who shows up at a hospital who tests positive for pregnancy and drugs or alcohol could fall under the auspices of this. And the concern is that now that women who might have terminated their pregnancies might not have that option, might not have the ability to travel out of state, it could become more routinely enforced.
How often is this act enforced here in Wisconsin? How common is it that there are reported concerns and enforcement?
Yeah, so it's hard to know exactly, and it varies county to county, but we have about 100, or excuse me, about 400 women a year are investigated under this law. And so that means that their reports are made and they're screened in by Child Protective Services for future or for further investigation. And when these cases end up, if they end up winding their way through the court system, that happens in juvenile court, which means that those records are protected and sealed from the public. So it's really a black box, and we don't know how many women like Alicia Beltran, like Tammy Leitcher, end up in jail because they have tried to fight this law.
Alongside your piece, Phoebe, at Wisconsin Watch, you shared some advice from experts here for women who may be facing concerns about this situation during a pregnancy. What were some of the things, the resources people shared with you?
Yeah, so one provider in particular, his name is Dr. Charles Schauberger. He said that, you know, people who are pregnant and using substances, they really should try to begin prenatal care as soon as possible because it's safer for them and their baby. They also shouldn't attempt to delay treatment or hide their pregnancy, but they should be really careful about who they get prenatal care from. Seeking out medical providers who are experienced in caring for women with substance use during pregnancy, drug treatment programs, and other women who have used drugs and had recent pregnancies might be good sources of referral if they don't know who to go to. And it's my understanding that Charles Schauberger and a couple other people are working on a database of providers who would be good, thoughtful, and not jump to calling CPS.
Phoebe, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much.
Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch. She talked about her piece on Wisconsin's fetal protection law. You can find a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new congressional session starts off with drama in the U.S. House. We'll get the latest news wherever it is tomorrow and look at the big issues in the year to come. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Evers kicked off his second term yesterday, and Wisconsin lawmakers were sworn in for a new session. We'll preview what's in store for divided government this year at the state capitol. First, if your vehicle was 30 years old, had no AC or airbags, and got 8 miles to the gallon, you might think about replacing it, right? That's where the U.S. Postal Service is at. May take some time to update all 217,000 vehicles in their fleet. And we learned at the end of last month that the Postal Service plans to begin purchasing lots of electric vehicles, including 45,000 from Wisconsin-based defense contractor Oshkosh, most likely produced at an out-of-state facility, though. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about changes happening at the U.S. Postal Service? What do you think about many of the vehicles getting electrified? Do you like that plan? Are there other changes you would like to see for the Postal Service? Do you have questions for ongoing changes there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jacob Bogage covers business and economics at the Washington Post. He's been covering the Postal Service for quite a while now and wrote about the electric vehicle transition just before Christmas. Jacob, welcome back to Central Time.
It's always good to be with you, Rob.
This has been a long and winding road, right? The Postal Service knew it needed to get new vehicles. Electric was a big question mark. What pushed it over the edge to make this this big change?
Tell me about it. Yeah, this is a really long and winding road. The vehicles that the Postal Service has on the street right now have been running since between 1987 and 1994. These trucks are older than me, and I'm 28. These are 30-year-old trucks. What pushed this over the edge is the Biden administration got involved here. The Biden administration reached out to the Postal Service around this time last year and said, your original plan to not purchase many electric trucks, simply not good enough. And kept up that pace when the Inflation Reduction Act, that's the landmark legislation championed by President Biden and congressional Democrats, passed over the summer. That included $3 billion for the Postal Service to go buy electric mail trucks and the charging infrastructure they need. And that's what pushed this over the finish line, that influx of funding, the continued pressure from the White House, and the Postal Service wanting to maximize those resources.
And another part of the story, there were some changes. Congress allowed some changes for the Postal Service, some basic finance stuff for them that seems to have loosened up some of the purse strings there. What happened? How important is that when it comes to the vehicle story?
That's a great point. Yeah. In the spring of 2022, Congress overhauled the Postal Service's budget. It didn't really give them a lot of money, but the Postal Service had a lot of debt. And Congress said, we're going to write a lot of that off. $50 billion in future amounts, $57 billion in past due amounts. So we're talking a lot of money. That allowed the Postal Service, which actually has considerable cash reserves, but not nearly enough to pay off its debt, to put that money into buying new equipment that they have been well behind on purchasing. The top priority on their list was new delivery trucks.
Now, they've made the decision to go electric with so many of their vehicles. That is not something you wave a magic wand and they're on the streets tomorrow. What is the process going to look like?
Yeah, and this is, I've done a lot of reporting on this and traveling with the Postmaster General to really see what implementation looks like. The first electric vehicles, let's start here. The first of the new vehicles manufactured by Oshkosh are going to start hitting the street at the end of 2023. So that factory is still getting built out. They're still hiring workers. That's down in South Carolina, not in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And those will start hitting the street in 2023. Electric vehicles will be part of that early mix, but will really pick up closer to 2025, 2026. After 2026, the Postal Service says it plans to buy exclusively electric vehicles. And that's because it's going to have enough lead time to upgrade the infrastructure in its facilities. Think about that small town post office in your neighborhood. It probably can't support an electric vehicle right now. And now multiply that by all the small towns across the country. That's way too expensive. It's not really feasible to do that kind of transformation. If you can change the route structure, and that's something the Postmaster General is investing a lot of time in, if you can change the route structure and put these at bigger industrial facilities that have the infrastructure, it's a lot more affordable. And so implementing electric vehicles is going to come with kind of an entire suite of changes to kind of the basic blocking and tackling of how we get our mail.
And you alluded to there, Jacob, another point of controversy in this saga, a Wisconsin company making many of these vehicles, not here in Wisconsin. And there were union labor concerns. It still are criticisms that, hey, these are going to be made by this Wisconsin company, but in South Carolina.
Yeah, and there are still union concerns. Oshkosh Defense and the workers out in Wisconsin, represented by the United Auto Workers, shortly before the Postal Service finalized its choice with Oshkosh, the company told the government, actually, we're not going to make these vehicles in Wisconsin. We're going to make them in South Carolina at a non-union facility. Theoretically, labor is going to be cheaper there. But Oshkosh is also reporting difficulties with hiring in South Carolina and finding a qualified workforce to do it. They're reporting the same kind of supply chain snags that we're all experiencing as the pandemic has worn on. This was not, moving to a non-union facility is not a guarantee that things are going to be cheaper. And you're certainly handcuffing yourself when it comes to getting qualified labor, though I'm sure the folks in South Carolina are just as hardworking as the folks in Wisconsin. So those are, there's controversy in who's doing the work, but there are also real world consequences in when we're going to start seeing these trucks on the street.
Talking to Jacob Bogage with the Washington Post, looking at the U.S. Postal Service, including but not limited to the transition to electric vehicles at the USPS and other changes, reforms, long-term plans at the Postal Service. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Couple things. I they made a change probably a couple of years ago now that mail that is local to in Madison goes to Milwaukee and to be canceled and then comes back to Madison. And it seems like it used to take maybe 2 days for mail to be delivered, and now it might take 4 or 5 days for mail to delivered. And the other thing is that the mail carriers sometimes are delivering mail at 7 o'clock at night, and I feel sorry for them if they have to work such long days.
Okay, thanks for the call. Jacob, the route that mail takes has had some changes. The timing has had some changes. What kind of things are out there?
Yeah, let's take this in reverse. And Kay, thank you for bringing up those points. In terms of how late mail carriers are out on their routes, I mean, a lot of that is seasonal. And when there's more volume or more packages, they're going to be out on their routes later. And believe me, I hear from letter carriers that I work with, that I talk to all the time, that is something that they are not fond of as well. In terms of the route that mail takes and where it gets processed, a lot of that is undergoing or has undergone and will continue to undergo transitions. And this is part of this much longer tail to the decision to go to electric vehicles, because part of that is you simply cannot ship mail all over the place. And we're going to do one type of sorting here, and then we're going to send it to another plant and do a separate type of sorting and a third and a fourth. There's way too many steps involved with just physically sorting mail these days. And that's something the Postmaster General, when I interview him, talks to me about all the time. Eliminating a lot of those steps is going to be more efficient. It's going to be better for the environment because there's going to be less energy, less trucks on the road. But it's also going to open up space in these facilities to dispatch carriers from and reorient carrier routes, which will enable electric vehicles. So again, there is this really kind of, you have to get in the weeds, this really long tail to what, it's not one simple decision. It's a lot of really complex decisions that kind of have to dovetail together in a very precise way. And we're going to see the rubber hit the road on that, quite literally.
Thanks for that call, Kay. We're talking to Washington Post, a business and economics reporter, Jacob Bogage, about U.S. Postal Service plans to replace its old and inefficient gas-powered delivery trucks with new electric ones, as we hear, a lot of them getting replaced over the next couple few years, plus other issues, reforms, changes at the Postal Service. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest. If you have thoughts on what you want to see from the Postal Service, if you work there or have in the past, love to hear your perspective as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Jacob Bogage, who covers business economics and the U.S. Postal Service at the Washington Post, looking at the latest news from the Postal Service, including their plans to purchase electric vehicles for its delivery fleet. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences with mail over the last couple of years, changes you might like to see. Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Kelly is joining us in the Madison area. Kelly, hello.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, a couple minor points with regard to the Postal Service. We are looking at an expenditure every year. As we all know, stamp prices go up, and the Postal Service seems hamstrung with their costs, heavily subsidized by the government and the cost of stamps. But with the electric vehicle implementation, and we know that electric vehicles are not exactly cheap right now, what I'm curious to know is, how does the public plan to accept the cost structure of raising prices to pay for these vehicles, as well as, is there any chance that the Postal Service can be completely revamped with regard to being more efficient, such as other third-party mail delivery services? We all know that FedEx, UPS, DHL, seem to have a better efficiency structure, and I'm wondering how the Postal Service plans to implement
I gotcha, Kelly. A lot there, Jacob. Let's start with that second point first, the efficiency of the Postal Service versus the other carriers. Now, the Postal Service, by law, has to provide services to places that are not profitable, may not be efficient. How do we compare and contrast there, Jacob?
Rob, you nailed it. Yeah, the Postal Service has got to go over the hill and around the bend, and FedEx and UPS and Amazon and DHL do not. And that is a major advantage and disadvantage for the Postal Service. They have to go there, which means they are not, it's not necessarily profitable, and it costs more to dispatch a letter carrier all the way out there. But because they have to go there, there are more opportunities. And in fact, the Postal Service delivers a lot of Amazon's packages, has relationships with FedEx and UPS and DHL to make deliveries to unprofitable areas. And by law, the Postal Service has to turn a profit on every delivery. So, you know, we've heard a lot of discussion, and I think your caller alluded to it, that the Postal Service is subsidizing these private carriers. It is not. It is profitable on every delivery it makes. Now, are some of those more profitable than others? Absolutely. Is there a lot of infrastructure to the delivery network that maybe is not taken care of by every single delivery? Yeah, that's also true. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's losing money on some of these trips. There was so much in that question, Rob. Redirect me.
Yeah, and Kelly's other point was he's worried that you know, this is going to raise costs. These electric vehicles, not cheap. Infrastructure changes, they cost money to do. Are consumers going to bear the costs of these changes?
Yes. I mean, there's no way around that. Yes, they are. Now, the price of a stamp right now is 60 cents. A forever stamp, first class stamp, is 60 cents. A year ago, it was 58. Or excuse me, 6 months ago, it was 58. 6 months before that, it was 55. 6 months before that, it was 53. So we are seeing these steady increases. And frankly, they do outpace inflation. But the price of mailing a letter in the United States is cheaper still than pretty much everywhere else in the world. This is not going to have, when we talk about price increases for the Postal Service and on postage products, the biggest impact this is going to have is on commercial mailers. It's not going to have a tremendous impact on individuals like you and me or our wonderful caller who are sending Christmas presents or holiday cards or birthday cards or even getting bills through the mail or sending remittances through the mail. This is really going to have a larger effect on commercial mailers. Think banks, insurance companies, pharmacies that send prescriptions.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kelly. Maddie joins us next in central Wisconsin. Maddie, hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. A question relating to the changeover a few years back. You go into the post office and there were two slots, one for out of town and another for in town. Then that was discontinued. Now, whether it was nationwide or just, you know, here or there, but it was with a few places that I visit. And if you just mail a card in Black River Falls or Wisconsin Rapids or Marshfield, it ends up going God knows where and takes 4 or 5 days to come back. Why was that eliminated in some way for some strategy?
Thanks for that call, Maddie. And Kay mentioned that earlier, a Madison to Madison piece of mail might well travel via Milwaukee on the way. It's more efficient to take it out of town rather than keep that local stuff local, Jacob?
Sometimes it is, because it depends who's doing that sorting. I mean, mail is generally these days not sorted in the back of the post office when you drop it off. It goes into the bin, they take the bin somewhere else, it gets run through a machine, it comes back. Believe it or not, in most cases that is more efficient, because you don't have somebody in the back of a post office flinging envelopes into different bins. You know, you have a machine that can read everybody's handwriting and can do it for you. It frankly is more efficient. And the Postal Service would rather have those clerks who are so well-trained up at the front of the shop helping customers than they would have somebody back behind the window, back behind the racks, flinging envelopes left, right, and center. So, you know, this is why I love writing about the Postal Service, because it seems like such a cut and dry kind of, we give you the mail, you deliver the mail. No, this is a highly complex and integrated agency that touches all of us. And there are so many kind of fundamental questions about its role in our community and where our stuff goes. And I really appreciate that question.
Maddie, thanks for the call. Talking about the U.S. Postal Service with Jacob Bogage from the Washington Post. Time for another caller. Mike is with us in Wausau. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was going to ask about the Postal Service delivering packages for Amazon and big companies, but I think you already answered that. So I'm just going to go off the air with one statement, and I applaud them going to electric vehicles. People don't realize, but industry has been using electric forklifts since the 1960s. So just making that point.
Mike, thanks for the call. There is some enthusiasm out there, Jacob, for the electric changeover.
Yeah, that's a great point. And frankly, when I talk to environmental activists who have been pushing the Postal Service on this, they bring up the electric forklifts every time. The amount of times people have told me about electric forklifts, because you're right, it is something that's flown under the radar. And that's a great point. I think one of the reasons why the Biden administration has been so enthusiastic about this is that this is a huge order of electric vehicles, which means you've got to have the factory set up. You've got to source the parts. You've got to source the batteries. You've got to figure out what you're going to do when you recycle batteries. I mean, this forces a major agency to set up processes to deal with this energy transition. And because the Postal Service is doing it, it's going to make it easier for other private sector companies to do the same thing. And I think that is why they're the most excited for this. It really sets a mold that the rest of the logistics industry can follow. FedEx, UPS, Amazon, they have all made their own climate pledges, and some are more ambitious than others. The Postal Service, in this one announcement, jumped all the way to the front of the line.
Thanks for that call, Mike. In our last minute and a half or so, Jacob, I wanted to talk about the fundamentals of the Postal Service. I remember not that long ago, the talk was we sent emails instead of mail. The UPSs and FedExes and Amazons are taking all the profitable package delivery routes. There's nothing left for the Postal Service to do that's going to make them money. It doesn't seem like I'm hearing that kind of doom and gloom about the Postal Service lately.
Well, the fundamental issue hasn't changed. We still do send emails and text messages. We still, FedEx, Amazon, UPS still want to take the most profitable routes. We're not hearing the same amount of doom and gloom because the Postal Service is not facing the same kind of financial distress. That is because it got its debt completely, almost completely wiped out by Congress. It doesn't mean the business model is any better. It doesn't mean the profitability is getting any better, but it does mean that there is finally some coin in the piggy bank that it can tap to make these modernizations. Eventually, Congress and the American people are going to have to decide how we want the Postal Service to exist in our country. Do we want it to be supported by people who send mail and packages, or do we want to support it with our taxes because we feel like we need a post office?
Jacob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Jacob Bogage. He covers business and economics at the Washington Post. We talked with him today about the U.S. Postal Service plans to replace delivery trucks with electric vehicles, plus some other big news in mail delivery. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the year ahead in Wisconsin state politics with budget negotiations on the horizon. A lot of important stuff there for the next couple of years. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.